It's all yours.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dan Greer. And my current sobriety date is Monday, January 14th, 1991. I'm fortunate I have a lot of days, because I heard in an AA meeting somebody described a guy as too many years and not enough days. And boy, that I knew what they meant by that. Let me tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And this morning I was thinking, my God, this is a completely different Sunday morning than I spent from the time I was born up until my early 30s. It maybe even beyond that. The first time, when I was 17, late in my junior in high school, I had had a few beers. I'd been to parties, and I thought I had been, you know, ooh, I got drunk last night, and it was nothing. Mouthwash was stronger than what I drank. But I was out with my friend. We were going around, and I was drinking beer really fast. And he said, "You better slow down." And I answered, honestly, "I'm just thirsty." And this was on an empty stomach in the hot sun. And it ended up with me puking all over the place, embarrassing myself, and scared to death knowing my parents were going to find out. This friend came over the next morning. He had more experience with beer and with alcohol than I did. And he said, I said to him, and I meant this, "I am never doing that again. Why would I? I am never doing that again." And I meant it. No way. That was in late May. By the Labor Day of that summer, at the end of that summer, I probably had done it three or four more times. And it was from that point on that I lived what I like that the title of that book by Pete Hamill, The Drinking Life. I didn't think, you know, for years, I mean, years into AA meetings, I didn't think, it's not like all I did was think about drinking and all that. But it's the truth. My whole life was centered around drinking. And so when I finally got the book, and here it is, this is the one they shoved in my hand, my first meeting. I didn't even have the $5 at that point to pay it off. But on page 31, the second chapter talks about, here are some methods we have tried to control and enjoy our drinking. And, you know, the first time I read the big book, I only read the parts that applied to me. So but I did read that. And even after, all, you know, 7, 8, 9 years of drinking and again getting worse, when I read those, I go, well, I didn't do that. Well, I never did that. Well, I don't do that. And it wasn't until years later that I look back and I go, oh, my God, I tried to control in my drinking 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I tried all different things that aren't even in this book. And so it being a Sunday morning, I got to tell you, I had a great Sunday morning. I stayed up, watched last night, watched a very good football game, Texas A&M and Notre Dame. They were really going at it. It was great. Slept well, got up, had coffee, read the papers online, feeling good, had my, took a great shower, and I'm feeling wonderful. That's a hell of a lot different than many Sunday mornings, many. Where I grew up in an alcoholic family. My dad was an alcoholic and some of my older brothers were. So it was Sunday mornings were step quietly. And Sunday morning, a lot of Sunday mornings, I know I was thinking next weekend will be better. Next weekend, I'll do this. But I went to an alcohol counselor years later and I talked about how I hated Sundays, hated them. He goes, "No kidding. That's hangover day in an alcoholic house. No way. Yeah, that's bad." So what was it like? I went from that point on, I drank, but I controlled it. I only drank on weekends, except for Thursday nights in the summer, and some Sunday afternoons. I didn't drink going to Buffalo Bills football games because I knew, no, I want to watch this game. I didn't drink while I skied. I drank afterwards. What other controls? I mean, there were so many. Just I didn't even think about it. But it took a long time before I sobered up enough to look back and say, my God, I constantly was either coming off a drinking spell, planning the next drinking spell, or even when I was drinking, I was always 20 minutes ahead. You know, oh, that's good. This, you know, I'm only going to have two beers or something, or, you know, I'd search for that. What I always thought was search for that eternal two beer buzz. You know, after two beers, I felt great. This is wonderful. This is, you know, this is good. But no. And then also when I was drinking, the day I never lived the day I was in, I was always 6 months in advance. And a guy on the meeting told me this story. We laughed our heads off. They show The Office. There's the character. She has a drinking problem, but they're doing an office thing of where do you see yourself in 5 years? And it gets around to her, and she goes 4.5 years sober. Oh my God. I burst out laughing. And my buddy said he did. Nobody else in his family got it. You know, I was always six. You know, 6 months from now, things are going to be great. Six, you know, always ahead. I gave up drinking for a few Lents, two Lents. And there, I did count days there, but I counted from 40 down to, in my family, I was taught, Lent ends Holy Saturday at noon. I had a ceremony. I mean, I had the Michelob ice from Thursday till Saturday morning, Saturday at noon, high noon, cap it off there. There. Aren't I good? I don't have a problem. Years later, I was on a date with a woman, and she said, only alcoholics give up drinking for Lent. This has been a long time since I've been in AA. I was still angry at her. Who the hell are you to excuse me of being an alcoholic? And another buddy on the call today, we found out. After we got an AA, we were going to mass at the same place, and the priest told us, "Oh no, the 40, if you count it, the 40 days is Ash Wednesday to Palm Sunday." Both of us were like, "What? We missed out on a week of drinking, you know?" Because he had done it too, and my father had done it. I watched my father. He gave up drinking for a few Lents. My mom was sick after the last child was born. I'm from a family of nine. And so he gave up drinking for a year. So I knew this is how you do it. You know, this is how you control it. This is how you control and enjoy your drinking. So what other forms of controlling and enjoying my drinking? If anybody, I once, one of the years the NFL was on strike, we went down to Ellicottville for the Fall Fest. I got really, really drunk, really drunk. So the next year, to control it, I said, I'll be the designated driver. And this is after that, there was a off-duty cop who Monday after the Fall Fest, some year right around there, had killed two women running on the street. You know, and I remember people work saying, how can that happen? And I was thinking, how can it not happen? But I'm going to control it. I'll be the designated driver. And this is when they were first coming out. So as a designated driver, I knew that if I only drank 12 ounces of alcohol in an hour, I would never get drunk. So we go to Madigan's, the first bar, and my buddy is buying the first round, and he hands them back to me, places jammed. And they're just selling the 7 ounce splits, if you remember those. And I was like, all right, I can do this. So I had a 7 ounce beer in my hand. I'll take the smallest sip I can. And then after 40 minutes, I can get another beer and then just drink 5 ounces of that before the hour's up. It'll work out fine. So I took the tiniest sip and very little was left in the bottle. I was like, damn it. All right. So I finished that split off in like 12 minutes. All right, I'll get another one, but this one I'll nurse for a while. Well, my friends all, you know, they have a designated driver, so they got drunk. So I drove home and not for the first time, seeing double. So I closed one eye and I made it home. I drove drunk all the time. I didn't realize it. I thought I only was driving drunk when I saw double. But I drove drunk, and I'm talking from Buffalo back out to Orchard Park where I grew up, in two or three absolute blackouts, let alone a lot of times closing one eye. And that's when I thought I was drunk. I found out later, oh no, after a beer and a half, you're over the limit, even when it was 1.0. And I never got a DWI. I don't know. The guy who just killed the two hockey players, boy, I can identify with that. I was like, yep. Holy geez, how I escaped that, I don't know. But that was, controlling the drinking. Later, I heard some guy kept an eye patch in his car. And if a cop stopped him, he quickly put on the eye patch and say, oh, I just had surgery. That's why I'm bobbing and weaving. And I thought, that's brilliant. You know, that's how we do it, to control and enjoy my drinking. And God bless this guy, Jay, who's no longer with us in outfit, but he's the first one who told me, whenever I controlled my drinking, I never enjoyed it. When I was enjoying my drinking, I was out of control. And my former wife was not an alcoholic, and she said she got the bed spins once, and she hated it and never drank to that excess again. This is back when she was a teenager. And I explained to her, oh, no, the control for that is you put one foot on the floor. And if they're really bad, you put the other foot on the wall. No problem. You know, it's like, my God, just drinking, drinking, drinking. Joined a frat in college that was known to be the biggest drinkers. And, you know, I'm not as bad as those guys. I'm not as bad as so-and-so. And then after college is when I said, okay, I kind of had a feeling maybe something's off in drinking, but there were plenty of others who drank more than I did. After college, now it started to be like, I did not mean to get that drunk last night. What happened? I'll do a better controlling it. And for about 4 or 5 years after college, it just got worse. I just would wake up from 2 a.m. thinking, my God, what the hell happened? You know, I'll do better. You know, I gotta slow down. I think that's one of the lengths I gave up. And my friends were starting to get married and move up in their jobs. And I felt like I was just stuck. And I was like, how did they do that? I have one friend since third grade. When he was designated driver, he would go out, he would have one, maybe two beers, then switch to Coca-Cola and drink that from 10 at night till 2 a.m. when it was time for us to go. I was like, how the hell do you do that? Not that I said that to anybody. So it's gotten worse. And at this time, my father had entered the program when I was in college, but he never told me about it, but he did have a big book by his bed. And so, I think I picked it up a few times and leaped through it. And I also read everything on, in Reader's Digest. I am like those articles, I am Joe's liver. So I knew a lot about alcohol, trying to control it. You know, there's got to be a way to control this. And it was getting bad. And so I started a new job at a great company now known as Ingram Micro. I was employee number 17 and it was going well. But the first day I showed up, my first day was the day after Labor Day weekend, and I had been to a wedding. I showed up my first day home. And then that went on later the fall of 1984. And I'm at a Buffalo Bills game. And this is when the Bills would finish 1-13, 2-12, things like that. I told you, I would not drink at Bills games. And they're playing the Dallas Cowboys. And the first offensive play of the game, the Bills, Greg Bell runs the ball for 75 yards and a touchdown. Without even thinking, I stand up and say, I'm going to have a beer. And I did. So the Bills ended up winning that day 14-7. Does anybody think I limited my beers to just touchdowns? No. It became another first down. Let me have a beer. Oh, my God, a timeout. How about another beer? And so later later that night, we're in the local bar in Orchard Park, and I'm just hammered. And yeah, the next day, really hungover. And we had already talked at work. People said, you know, if you're not feeling well, come into work and show us, and then you can go home. So I did that. And I laid down on the couch, not for the first time, spending a whole day asking what's wrong with me. And the higher power thought it'd be funny is that the day I'm lying on the couch trying to recover from a massive drunk, the guys are moving into the flat upstairs, up and down the stairs, boom, 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 boom. And I said, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. 6 weeks later, it's Christmas. I'm at work, pretty busy at work. It's the day before the Christmas break. People are having parties in all their cubicles. I am leaving the work. And Shelly, God bless her, haven't seen her, I think, since this day, says to me, hey, so-and-so sent me a bottle of vodka, some customer, come on over. I said, sure, vodka wasn't my drink. Yeah, I'm coming over for one drink because I got to go. I got stuff to do tonight. I go over there. The next thing I know, it's 2 hours later, I'm in the warehouse arguing with a guy why he's got to go back to New York City and play the bass guitar and follow his dreams. About 3 hours after that, I'm driving a girl named Caroline home so she can change, and I think I'm going to score. And I remember her name because it was Christmas. So for about an hour, I kept saying to myself, Christmas, Caroline, Christmas, Carol, Christmas, Caroline. Even knowing her name didn't work. I came home, sharing the apartment with the guys, stumbling, driving drunk again. And my friends, you know, you go to bed. He's just laughing at me. The next day, that Saturday, this is the first time, and this was happening stronger, but this is the first time I woke up and I said, I am getting drunk today. And I did. We went what we called Christmas shopping, which meant going to TGI Fridays at the Boulevard Mall. Again, I'm driving. Oh, by the way, I'm driving an uninsured, unregistered vehicle with 3-year-old Virginia plates on them, living in Buffalo. A perfect alcoholics car. And I'm driving two friends of mine. One of the friends is the guy who, when I was 17, said, oh, it'll happen again. We drove home. I went home. I don't know if I showered and then went out to a Christmas party where I proceeded to insult everybody from what I remember and really being drunk and drove home. The next morning, I came to. The only way to describe it. And immediately started hearing a calm, quiet voice in my head say, you've run out of luck. You've run out of luck. And I knew what it meant. So I'm stumbled out of my bed, stumbled out to where I parked my car to make sure there was no blood on the hood. There wasn't. There was vomit down the driver's side door. In the back, there was a taco dip I insisted on saving from Friday night. Now it's Sunday morning. It's snowing. I'm still drunk, really. And I'm just like, I can never drink again. I can't. But I have to go pick up my 15-year-old sister who's visiting friends. My parents had moved to Florida. I have to pick her up and we have to drive to Syracuse and spend Christmas with my other sister. So I pick her up. This is a stick shift, by the way. She has her permit because Florida gave permits at that time at 15 years old. We get through the Williamsville toll barrier. I pull over the side. It's snowing. I say, you're driving. She's like, what? I got her in the driver's seat. I shifted and I said, just keep going. And I half slept and recovered till we got before the exit. I said, pull over, you know, 2 hours later, 2.5 hours later. And I drove the rest of the way. Later, I wrote her a letter making an amends, putting her in that position. Got to my sister's. I had a ceremonial last beer, went down like battery acid. And I got back to Buffalo. One of my controls was, I'm not going out tonight. I'm going on the wagon. I'm taking it easy. So they were going out. They understood. When they left, I called AA. AA said, okay, what's your number? all right, somebody will call you back. And I hung up the phone scared to death. Like, oh no, they're going to call tomorrow morning. Somebody else is going to answer it. And they're going to ask, because this is what I thought, can we speak to the loser who can't drink anymore? But they didn't. They called back right away. And they had a meeting down the street, and I went to it. It's in that place called the Harvest House on Seneca Street. It was dark. It was smoky. There was this speaker meeting. The guy was from Dunkirk. During the meeting, I wasn't a smoker, but I picked up chewing tobacco, you know, the Skoal. And I was trying like crazy to quit that in college. And I remember this. He said, although those of you who are smoking, you might as well quit now because it's the same thing. It's the same step, you know, the same way you do it. And I said to myself, I love this, that I remember I said this. I said, no, let me get control of my drinking. Then I'll get control of that. Okay. They shoved the book in my hand. They gave me all the cards. And I got it. Went out and over the next 2 weeks, snuck off to a few other meetings. One of them, Abbott Men's. And this was in early January now of 85. And I was concerned about St. Patrick's Day. I hated St. Patrick's Day. Nobody got as drunk as they promised. But I asked a guy I thought would know named Fitz. I go, what about St. Patrick's Day? He goes, yeah, that's a concern, but not today. We stay in the day we're in. Also, I can't recall which of those meetings somebody said to me, any idiot can quit something for 24 hours. And boy, did I latch onto that. Not that I said anything to him, but inside I was saying, who the fuck are you to call me an idiot? I'll show you. I won't drink. And now I had two thoughts in my head during this time. One, I'm so deathly embarrassed. I'm an alcoholic. I don't want anybody to know. And two, it's my problem. I'll handle it. I don't need anybody's help. That was it. And I didn't go to any more meetings because I really thought you only went to meetings if you're ever in trouble not drinking. And I latched onto that. Don't drink the day you're in. Don't drink the day you're in. And that's all I would say all day in my head is, God, please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink. So come around April, I realize I've gone two full days without consciously thinking of that. So what do I proclaim myself? Oh, shit. That was easy. Cured. So I don't drink. This is the time when ice beers were coming out. I'd have little sips of my friend's beer. But it felt awful. But this is because I saw my dad at my sister's wedding at the toast. I saw him, what it looked like he was shipping the champagne. Maybe he just put it up to his mouth. I don't know. So I just am not doing it. And then my mom, her cancer come back. She died in May of 85. I didn't drink through that. I go, there we go. You know, I can handle this. And it goes on. And, in November 1st of 1986, that same friend who was there that morning of the 17th, the same friend I drove around drunk as the designated driver, and the same friend I was out at his cottage last night where I did a lot of drinking, having a great time, because none of us drink a whole lot anymore, I certainly don't. It was his wedding. By this time, I'm the full-time designated driver. I'm in the wedding. We're driving from the ceremony up to Niagara Falls for the reception, and they're passing around a bottle of champagne. I'm taking little sips because I know how to control this, and I start to feel that buzz. And I go, holy shit, nothing. That's the last conscious drink I ever took. I don't think I've had any alcohol since then. I can't, you know, mistakenly drinking something or nothing. Just no. The chewing tobacco, from that point on, it already had taken off. But from the point where I said, I can't have that, skyrocketed in usage. And everything with alcohol, I did with chewing tobacco. Buy it, canister, take a dip, throw it out, dig through the garbage can 3 hours later, put it back, you know, just stupid stuff. So moving along. So the years go by and life is pretty good. You know, I'm not... not dating anybody, you know, had a real strong relationship, but she broke it off And so I had a resentment against her, but it was justified. You know, she was in the wrong. And it gets to, I'm working for a company. It's a different company doing very well with it. The Saturday before Thanksgiving in 1990, I awaken a little depressed. I said, that's strange, because Saturdays are usually great days. The next day, I felt a little worse. It's all right. I've been working hard. You know, got a break coming up. Monday, I felt really bad. Tuesday, I'm barely hanging on. Wednesday, I'm like, oh my God, I just gotta recover over the weekend. I don't know what's wrong, but I'm really depressed. A different depression than I've ever had before or since then. Just so Thanksgiving, I got worse and worse. And by Monday, I'm just brutal. And so as the days go on, I'm having trouble sleeping, but I'm having trouble getting out of bed in the morning. I'm not suicidal, but I'm thinking, why bother? Why? Who cares? And I would get up and I'd turn on the shower. The shower would run for like 15, 20 minutes before I'd finally step into it. And people are starting to say, are you all right? Yeah, I'm fine. No, I wasn't. I couldn't understand what the hell's the matter with me. So it gets so bad. One day, I in late December, I close the car door. I'm going to an appointment. And I just burst into tears. So I race out to my doctor's office and bust in on him. Just say, can I see the doctor? So he goes in and he sees me. They're asking the questions. You just break up with somebody. This, I go, no, I don't know what it is. And he sends me to somebody else who has a new drug called Prozac. And he gives me a sample and I take one. Surprisingly, one didn't cure me, you know. And I just kind of bottomed out, like, oh my God, this is awful. But over Christmas, we're having a family gathering down in Washington, D.C. And so I'm down there. And by this time, my younger brother had joined the program. And every time he come up to visit me, he joined about a year and a half before I started going to meetings on a regular basis. He would leave a schedule. And every towel in my house used, but he would leave a schedule. And so I kind of knew about AA, but no, I didn't go. So my father, my brother, and I are at this restaurant in Georgetown called a Pied du Cochon. I apologize for anybody who speaks French, how I ruined that. But it's right across the street from the West Side Club, which is a great, great AA club on Wisconsin and O, if you're ever down there. And my brother goes, and that's my club up there. And so my father, oh, really? And so for the first time, the three of us talk about being alcoholics. And my father, still at this point, turns to me and goes, really? I just thought you quit drinking. I think back on that. I'm like, based on his family's history, he had five brothers and sisters, all of them alcoholics. You know, if your last name is Greer, I highly recommend, don't ever drink, because we got it. And, a few years ago, a buddy of mine who's a doctor, I said, I was probably alcoholic at my conception, wasn't I? And I just needed to wait to pour beer on top of it. He goes, yep. He goes, yeah, that's how it works. So we have a great talk that day about alcoholism and all that. And it centers around our other brother, Jim, who lives up in Toledo, who my father had been hearing his mother-in-law complain. He drinks too much. So I have no idea how I came up with this, but we plan out a 12-step call. I go, look, I got some more vacation time. I'll get back to Buffalo, drive over to Toledo. Dad, you call Dick, a guy I used to work with who's a member of AA, and we'll do a 12-step call in Jim. And we did. And I'm telling you, this is my experience. Every 12-step call works perfectly. Because Jim walked upstairs to the office and he sees me. He goes, oh my God, I just saw a car with New York plates and thought of you. Sits down and we tell Jim about this. And Jim goes, I don't think so. I have a problem with cigarettes, but I don't think I have a problem with drinking. And Jim says, and Dick is doing most of the talking. And I can barely see Dick out of my side of my eye. And Jim goes, well, I'll just quit drinking. And I'm slightly nod my head because I know that's what you do. You just stop drinking one day at a time. You know, any idiot can quit something. And the 12-step call ended with this. Dick Bear saying, that's good, Jim. But this is a disease that needs constant treatment and therapy, and we get that at meetings. If somebody had slightly tapped me, I would have fallen over. I was like, oh my God, he's right. Jim, God bless him, got a big book, went to meetings for about a month and just said, I don't think I have a problem. God bless him. And, but I went back to Buffalo and from my brother's brother and father walked in on Monday, January 14th, 1991 to the University Men's Meeting. And that depression I had lifted. I mean, I could feel it going out. And I was like, holy shit, this is my problem. This is what I need. And since that time, it's rare I've gone a week without going to meeting. And so that's what it was like. Here's what happened. Oh my God. I started going to meetings. I started doing this. I started hearing about these things called the steps. I did hear about all these resentments you people had, but I didn't have any. I had the one against the ex-girlfriend, but she deserved it. I had no idea what you're talking about. So there was a great table in the back of all these veterans, and we would just do the steps in order, no reading, nothing, each week. All right, we're in step one. What's your experience, strength, and hope? What's your, and go around the circle. So we're doing this for most of that year, and it's coming up on the fourth step again. I think we're on step 11. And I go, uh-oh, I cannot say I'm working on the fourth step again. These guys are going to jump down my throat, you know, as nice as they are. But another guy who had started the same time I did, even though we were talking about the 11th step, announced he had done the fourth step that week. My initial thought, I can't let him get ahead of me. No way. So on Monday, and I don't know what the day of the week, January 1st, 1992, I was up early. I wasn't hungover, pretty damn quiet in the city. I pulled out a piece of paper and a pen. And my sponsor at the time told me, I said, I have no idea, these columns and all that. He goes, yeah, me neither. Take out the 12 and 12 and write about the seven deadly sins. That's what I did. I wrote about the one I didn't think I had the most first. And I go, okay. So I take it out and I go, well, pride goeth before the fall. So I wrote about pride. So in about 2 hours, I did my fourth step. And I tell people, my fourth step only took me 2 hours and 9 months to do. 2 hours of writing it, preceded by 9 months of avoiding it. Finished it, walked around, went outside, walked around, very quiet. No angels coming down, no hosannas, just, okay, all right. I hope I've done it. I called my sponsor, I think that day or the next day, and said, hey, can I come over? Yeah, why? I want to do the fifth step. Whoa. No. We got to set away some time for this. Now I started to get worried. I'm like, uh-oh. But I go over and do the fifth step later that week. He points it all, you know, all out. It's fear, this, that, the other thing. And the other thing that happened was by doing the fourth and fifth step, I realized I was like a fish who lives in water and doesn't know it. I lived in resentments. I couldn't see them. Pulling that plug on the dam of resentments for the fourth and fifth step, they started going by like crazy. I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. One of the ways I avoided doing the fourth step was from the guys out in South Buffalo. I had actually made amends to that former girlfriend. I did it exactly the way they told me. And it worked. The resentment against her ended. And I was like, that can't be. It's gone, you know, gone. And so these resentments start going by. But from that point on, everything starts to open up. A couple of months, a friend, we had been talking. He talked seriously. Come on down to Columbus, Ohio. Let's start this business. Yeah. Go down there. It doesn't work out. From there, I get the feeling, hey, what do I want to do? I have jobs. What do I want for a career? So I decide, you know, the Jesuits do the kind of work I like. Yeah, but they still have those vows, you know, the celibacy one. But I couldn't shake the idea. So I started to pursue that. And the Jesuits were great. They weren't that excited about me showing interest. Well, we'll check it out, you know. And so for the next 8 months, I couldn't shake the idea and got accepted, joined the Jesuits. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. I was in for 6 years, but about year three, a small voice in my head, maybe the same one that said, "You've run out of luck," said, "As great as this isn't for you. Shut up, shut up. I've made my decision. I'm doing this." But it got louder and louder. And then my final year, I was in New York City teaching at a high school, and I asked this Jesuit to be my spiritual director. And I told him, "Here's what I'm going through." And he goes, "Have you already made up your mind?" I go, "No, that's I'm dying." And he goes, "Oh, this is a great opportunity." I'm like, "What are you talking about? I'm in agony here." He goes, "Oh, no, this is a great opportunity to get closer to God." So for about 5 months, he guides me through. In January, he tells me, "I think you should start praying for the courage to make the decision rather than praying for the decision." That week, I prayed for the courage. It became clear. There was no fear, nothing. Told him the next time I saw him in 2 weeks, and he goes, "That's great." He goes, "Dan, maybe you were only meant to be here 6 years, learn and go out and do, whatever you're going to do. There's a lot of guys I was in the Jesuits with who left who are better Jesuits than I am. I've been in 37 years. I don't know if I'm going to be here next year. You just don't know." And that has proven to be true. And I left. And a lot of people think, because at the same time I started dating this woman I had had off and on romantic relationships with, who shock to me, decided to separate from her husband with, even though she had five kids. So we started dating. We got married, and then 3.5 years into it, a little, she ended it. Okay, that was tough. That was that. I don't admit, I don't deny. Really difficult. But what did I do? Just pray. I prayed for her. Really tried to knock down the resentment every day. Eventually, I wrote her a letter about 5 years after the divorce. Found her, she had moved away, found her address online, wrote her a letter saying, "Here's what I think caused the end of what I did that caused the end of our relationship." Sent it off to her. I go, "Please, no need to respond. I will do this." I go, "The last line I wrote, I'm just seeking forgiveness." I was seeking forgiveness for myself, and it works. And ever since that time, it took a few more years, zero resentment, just about zero resentment against this woman. Just no, it just, okay, that's what it was. So when I think about what happened, it took a long time of meetings for me to look back and realize the drinking life was no fun at all. I thought I was having a great time. No. I've laughed harder, busted more balls, and had a better time in AA meetings than I ever did at any bar. Ever did. I just, this is, this is great. And I, for a long time, I thought the first step, in my mind, I was like, "I am powerless over alcohol, and we've ended up in a tie because I no longer drink." No, no. The powerlessness extends to my family. That brother who I made the 12-step call on, he was an alcoholic, and it took him forever. He drank himself out of his civil service job in Ohio. That's hard to do. Finally went to rehab, got about 5 months sobriety, had the greatest conversations with him in decades. He went back to Toledo after living in Washington, D.C., and for every reason, he picked up again. And the last thing he said to my older brother, our oldest brother, who had been in the program, who one of the greatest calls I ever got when I was in the Jesuits, he calls and says, "I've been going to meetings for the last month, finally." After 70 DWIs, he goes, "I finally said I'm an alcoholic rather than I'm investigating this program." And he goes, "Once I made that, said that, it's great." And this guy, my brother John, hell, he's still on the pink cloud. It's annoying. It's like, knock it off. But my brother Jim said to him, "John," the last thing he said to any of us, "John, the last, everything that they tell you in AA is true." Meaning, you pick up again. It's like you never stop drinking. And my brother Jim died within 100 days of picking up again. And we had done, my younger brother, who lives down in DC, had done a asked an attorney, what should I do? The attorney said, call the local cops. They'll do a call on them. So they did. And my brother answered the door. And he said, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. Okay. 2 weeks later, the neighbor calls the police and says, the mail is piling up outside this guy's door and I haven't seen him. So they, because they already had the name and address, they go there, go in, and my brother's dead on the floor. And since they have my brother's number, called him. So that's where my brother said, you know, many pursue this under gates of insanity or death, move from a theory to an absolute fact. And like Jim said at the beginning, whoever told me, yeah, I call them research and development. The people that go out almost do a hell of a lot more for me than the people who get it and feel wonderful. This guy, Shanzi, said, and Shanzi had gone 6 rehabs, South, a hard drinker. One day at a meeting in South Buffalo early on, he said, you know those guys that come in here and say, oh, this is great. This is great. This came right in time. I love this. I know, wonderful. He goes, those guys never make it. He goes, give me the guy who says 24 hours. I can't make it till 3 o'clock this afternoon. He goes, those are the guys that make it. And boy, that has proven to be so true to me. So every day I try and say, you are so close to a drink. You have no idea. You better hang on, you know, for dear life. And do the and doing the rest of the steps. I look back and I'm like, oh my God, as practicing these principles in all affairs, I hate to say it, I have so much gratitude lately. You know, I never liked the people that said, I got a ton of gratitude. But it works. It just, it works. It really does. I'm powerless over alcohol. I just watch what it does. You know, my brother Jim, cousins, uncles, aunts, friends. I sat at a lot of tables. There's a guy, Bill H., attorney in Buffalo, and some guy died. I told him, really? He took out his phone. This is just a few years ago, and started scrolling. And I mean, he scrolled for a while. And then he put in the guy's name at the last. He goes, I keep a name of all the guys that died directly from this. I think he should publish that every day. Here you go. Here's what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I said this to within the last year to my Owen, who I went to high school with, who has more days than I do. And I said, yeah, Owen, I always feel sometimes I concentrate too much on the not drinking and not living a sober life. He goes, yeah, okay, but don't kid yourself. If you drink, nothing happens. So drinking is about 99% of it. It's just, you can't drink. And then everything else comes in the way. And Owen had a son who died. So what happened, what it's like, what happened, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I went to this party last night out at the Lake Cottage in Gola with my friend from high school, where I did a lot of drinking. And he's there, and we're in the house his parents had. He bought it from them. We're now older than his parents were when we were out there in high school. He's got grandkids now, and we're having a lot of laughs and talking. He can drink. He doesn't have a problem with it. I'm having my seltzer water, loving it. We go over to this party at Bill Q's house, who some of you might know. That started at 5, and everybody brought over the greatest hors d'oeuvres, and some people were drinking, but it just was fun. It was laughing. It was looking at all these old, everybody's supposed to bring in all the old photos they could. Somebody came, one woman came up, here's a picture of your mom. I was like, wow, look at that. Yeah. And shortly after 7, my friend said to me, he goes, all right, we got to go. Bill only wanted this to go from 5 to 7. We left. And I texted Bill this morning, thanking him for the party, and said, a lot different than 45 years ago, when there's no way we would have left at 7. You know, we would have just been going. And it just was like, wow, that's, you know, unbelievable. The final thing, the one day at a time, I will say this. One day at a time truly is the only way to live. You really cannot do it. It's one day at a time. I heard this recently, and I love this. Guy said, what you do is you take an imaginary hula hoop, hold it over your head, drop it down so it's on the ground, and you're standing in the middle of it. Anything outside the hula hoop is none of your business. I go, that is so, that's great, you know? And I heard this in Al-Anon. I've gone to Al-Anon, and it said, other people's opinion of me are none of my business. And that's true now. I'm like this. And so, but the one day at a time, I told this guy, Dave, this. A year ago tomorrow, after I've been having dizzy spells and then speech slurring started for about 6 weeks, and being male and never having gone to med school, I, of course, said, well, it'll go away. No need to worry about it. Well, these two friends of mine who I call Dr. Moms, because they're both mothers who have had 3 or 4 kids and know more medicine than any doctor, both of them on Labor Day weekend said to me, would you get to an emergency room, please? The second one was on Labor Day Monday. She called and we were talking about that. And she goes, I'm not getting off the phone until you drive down. I don't care which emergency room you go to. So I said, all right. Got on the phone. She stayed with me. And I went to Gaze Vascular because I said, this is obviously a stroke. And she goes, they really know their stuff, Dr. Mom. She goes, when you go in there, tell them you have dizzy spells with speech slurring. I walk in. This is late in the afternoon, maybe early evening on Labor Day Monday. That it's crowded. I'm like, what the hell? I tell them what I have, right to the front of the line, right in there. MRI. Okay, you're going to stay overnight in the hospital as we do other things. I stayed overnight in the hospital for 12 nights and there's for 13 days. I had the greatest physical of my life. I wasn't having a stroke. They found a lesion inside my brainstem. They think is causing it, but they can't get to it because it's in the brainstem. And all the doctors, including my doctor, Dr. Jen, said, don't let anybody tell you they can get in there because they're just going to cause so much damage. They also found a growth in my lower abdomen. They go, do you know you had that? I go, no. They go, well, we're going to have to take that out. And I'm sitting there thinking, that's going to be cancerous. Cancer has a long and successful run in my family. That's going to be cancerous. They took that out in October, did a full biopsy or pathology, he called it. The surgeon called 2 weeks later. He goes, you know, we've been doing further research on this. It was just a growth. We have no idea what, you know, but keep going to the oncologist every 6 months for 3 years just to make sure. But you didn't even have liposarcoma, which sounds cancerous, but is not. So I will close with this. This last year, and then suddenly, I mean suddenly, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, my symptoms started to decline significantly. I rarely slur my speech anymore. And when I do, I can feel it, but it doesn't come out. Still slightly dizzy at times, but nothing like I spent 11 and a half months experiencing. And time's up. Thank you, Jim. Time's up. What? I'm vastly important. I should need to keep talking. But what being in the hospital, what this last year has shown me is, Dan, one day at a time. One day at a time. Thanks.